You're listening to a Business Ethics Podcast with Michael Connor.
Who's responsible for the current sorry state of American business? Well, that depends on whom you ask. Many would blame it on the management of big companies with their huge salaries, oversized bonuses, and corporate perks. But others would point to groups of well-paid and influential people who are supposed to be supervising the top executives. I'm speaking now of corporate directors, the members of the board. My guest right now is one of those who is convinced that corporate boards are a huge problem. In fact, he's so convinced that he has co-authored a book entitled Money for Nothing: How the Failure of Corporate Boards is Ruining American Business and Costing Us Trillions. John Gillespie was previously an investment banker for 18 years with Lehman Brothers, Morgan Stanley, and Bear Stearns, and also chief financial officer of a nationwide healthcare company. He joins us today to talk about his book and corporate boards. John, welcome.
Great. Thanks, Michael.
John, most experts would suggest that there are a multitude of reasons for the current problems in American business, and I'm sure you'd agree there are many, but you single out corporate boards as one of the primary culprits. Why is that?
Well, in part because it's who CEOs who've gotten a lot of the blame for our current problems are supposed to be reporting to, and even though most shareholders and taxpayers and others are pretty outraged at CEOs' greed, recklessness, and incompetence, and some of the firms that have melted down recently, there's not been a lot of focus on the negligence of boards of directors, or more importantly, on the systemic problems that don't allow the boards to do the jobs that they're supposed to be doing, which is monitoring the executives and advising the company to help shareholders' money grow.
One of the things I found most interesting in your book is your suggestion at one point, and you repeated it a couple of times, is that one of the basic problems is that boards can't really agree on their purpose. I mean, some people would say that the primary purpose is to increase shareholder value in the short term. In other words, help boost the stock price. Others would say it's focusing on a firm's long-term sustainability. And others would say it's balancing multiple stakeholder groups.
Yeah, I empathize a lot with the people who are willing to be directors these days. It's a tough job. They self-report dissatisfaction with a lot of it, and CEOs even report some dissatisfaction. They say that only 10 to 20% of their board members are asking the types of questions and assisting the company to the degree they'd want to. But it's a general problem that is something that board members themselves confidentially will tell you about. They've doubled the amount of time they're spending than they had 10 years ago on board work, but a lot of it's become check-the-box activities in requirements that they've had imposed on them, and they're not able to do the kind of strategic thinking or ethical consideration or monitoring of the CEO that they need to be doing. And it's become an entirely dysfunctional entity, and one that's become even more so recently.
Listening to you, I'm inclined, at least for a moment, to feel a little sorry for directors, but your book cites some egregious examples of directors who have been irresponsible. I think you said in 2008, the average Standard & Poor's 500 director earned $217,000 in fees.
Yeah, that was the average, and it ranges up to over $800,000, and you know, you take stock options and other things.
And many of these directors will sit on more than one board.
Exactly. They're kind of some hidden perquisites on some of them. They're probably the most egregious case of excess for a board and a CEO in recent years is one where the board members, in a year that the stock had dropped 60%, both awarded the CEO a $75 million bonus and themselves $842,000 in restricted stock and $670,000 in pay and perquisites that year, including up to 40 hours a year in use of the corporate jet for private purposes to fly to the Caribbean, Mexico, or anywhere in the U.S. We've seen some abuses there that are pretty outrageous.
Now, how does that happen? Theoretically, these boards are composed of smart, intelligent people who are themselves advised by attorneys. Is it pure greed, or does a certain madness set in here?
I'd say more the latter. I mean, certainly there's some greed, but I think what happens is that, by and large, board members are experienced, decent, intelligent people who are often tough business people, or if they come from government backgrounds or elsewhere, people who are real leaders and therefore come into board service. But once they get into the boardroom, they are in a bubble of entitlement and lack of diversity, where a lot of what they do does not follow what shareholders should be and are expecting of them.
Now, back in 2002, almost 8 years ago now, Congress passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Act after the scandals at Enron and WorldCom, and that brought about a number of changes, and many of them were supposed to address some of these problems, I believe. Have they not? Mm-hmm. Have they not changed anything?
Well, there are two phenomena. I think they have helped to some degree, and there's a history of, in the wake of scandals, either new regulations or some shaming of boards that helps, but it's quickly either circumvented or forgotten as a new bubble occurs and the excesses return. They get even worse and a new form of problem. So this time around, a lot of it related to lack of risk management and overcompensation. The Enron era ones were financial fraud for the most part. So you get reforms that focus on the cause and symptoms of the last set of scandals. The underlying problem still exists and comes back to haunt us. And because companies are getting much bigger, much more interconnected, and the whole global finance system is now, as a result, a ticking time bomb in some ways, we see these things happening more rapidly and in a much bigger form, just like in the last financial meltdown. If that isn't reformed, and we talk a lot about how to do so, I think the next set of not just scandals, but financial disasters could be a lot bigger than the one that had emergency things that kept it from getting as bad as it could have.
Well, that's a frightening thought. Let's talk about some of your suggestions for what might be done. We're speaking right now with John Gillespie, who's co-author with David Zweig of Money for Nothing, How the Failure of Corporate Boards is Ruining American Business and Costing Us Trillions. So, John, the potential solutions or at least ways of addressing the problem, what do you do?
Well, we present about 30 solutions that are pretty interconnected, and a lot of them are focusing on how do you increase the accountability and the transparency of what boards are supposed to be doing so that shareholders and taxpayers now, because taxpayers are getting hit up with this with bailouts of failed companies, can demand some action. It requires them to get informed and then outraged enough, but then how do you direct it to get those reforms? We divided the reforms into what we thought the most important ones in the beginning were to change the culture of boards. There's a big history of trying to regulate through legal changes how these things work, and a lot of those unfortunately have backfired or created requirements that are not cost-effective, created a lot of check-the-box work for boards, and Sarbanes-Oxley, as you mentioned, unfortunately did a lot of that. Some of the compensation reform things actually ended up exacerbating the compensation problem within companies. So what we're suggesting is, first of all, you need to reduce some of the conflicts that are inherent in the system. CEOs in the 500 largest companies in the country, 62% of them also serve as the chairman of the board, and 18% of the rest of them used to be the CEO of that particular company. So that's an inherent conflict that ought to be legislated away, because if one company allows it, you're getting into ego territory for CEOs at other companies, and they lose face if they're not the chairman.
You need to have a lot. Am I correct in that in Europe there is more of a division between the chief executive and the board, or oftentimes the chair of the board is more frequently an independent person?
Yes, much more. And in Great Britain in particular, they've gone through a bunch of corporate leadership crises in the early 90s and had a commission that had put that as one of their major recommendations, and that's become much more the norm in larger economies elsewhere. But one other thing that they do, because there's very little accountability with board members currently here, but most other countries allow 10% of shareholders to call for a so-called extraordinary general meeting where they can go in and remove bad board members. Right now, there's effectively no way to do so unless the board itself doesn't renominate them.
And it's very difficult for shareholders to even nominate a director.
Well, in this country, it's a bizarre system. William Donaldson, back in 2002, when the SEC had suggested some minor reforms there, and they got overwhelmingly lobbied against and killed by the Business Roundtable and Chamber of Commerce and a lot of lobbying entities that were spending shareholders' money to fight reforms that would have helped shareholders. They basically, the system does not allow shareholders to nominate directors. You're given what Donaldson called a Soviet-style election, where you can either vote for the one slate of nominees that the directors put up, or you can abstain. And in a lot of cases, even if you don't get a majority, even if you get one vote, you're in. And it's just a system that needs to be reformed so that there's a little bit more shareholder ability to hold supposedly their elected representatives to account if they're not doing their jobs.
You also talk about creating a new class of what you call public directors.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's something that we think could really change the culture of boards. The problem is that boards have become very insular, they're undiverse, they're almost all wealthy, white, older males. Only one in seven is a woman. We're suggesting that you create a new class of public directors. It's something that had been proposed back as early as the wake of the Great Depression and has been thought about recently. Our suggestion is that probably a third or more of the nominees for the board ought to come from a group of people who are mid-career switching to becoming professionals who used to be CEOs perhaps or CFOs or government officials that get trained in finance, ethics, and other issues and can come and be generalists on the board. They should also be trained in the specifics of the company's business, obviously. But to come in to actually be independent and provide some of the accountability and monitoring role that's necessary on board. Boards are supposed to monitor and provide advice, and many aren't doing so in part because they aren't independent, they aren't trained, and they're captured by the CEOs and executives in the company.
And then there's the big issue of shareholders and getting shareholders more engaged in one way or another. How do you even begin to address that?
Well, that's one big reason that we wrote the book. David Zweig and I took sabbatical for 2.5 years from our normal lives and spent a lot of time talking to board members and investors and lawyers and accountants and academics and a whole range of folks in this. One thing that's really clear is that there's a lot of anger out there. It's directed to CEOs right now and the pay issue, but shareholders who've lost a huge amount of their life savings recently, in large part because of bad corporate leadership in the boardroom, don't know where to direct it or how big the problems are. What we're trying to do in the book is help shareholders get informed, then outraged, and then directed towards some reform. So the whole issue of shareholders who currently practice what academics call rational apathy, because they don't have power.
It's a great term, rational apathy.
Yeah. Well, it's because they get these proxy forms to vote for one slate of directors, and they throw them out on open because they understand that it's sort of meaningless and it's shelved. So shareholders sort of need to demand some legal changes, but more importantly, changes in the culture of the board and the rules under which boards are allowed to operate, so that there's more accountability and a lot more disclosure and a lot more ability for being sure that who the people on the board are aren't there becoming stale and too close to management, and exercise both some independence and monitoring functions.
Does increased regulation or legislation play a role in this, John?
I think so, but there are things that you can regulate, like requiring the chairman not to also be allowed to be the CEO, possibly requiring a minimum percentage of investment from a director's own wealth in a company, as opposed to being given free stock where they don't really are aligned with shareholders' interests as a result of that. You could change the requirements to allow the extraordinary general meeting that I talked about that could allow shareholders to remove directors. You could require risk committees, because I think that was a lot of the problem this last time around. Boards weren't looking at risks, and they should be. And you can open the nominating process. But more importantly is getting processes and a movement behind investors to both get informed and demand changes at the companies. Investors, if they got together, and I think the Internet over time will allow a lot more of that through how voting is done and how information is shared, that we can get some of the bad directors out and more focus on ethics and more focus on strategy and more focus on how to grow companies, as opposed to how to check boxes that some of the regulations that do exist have made, unfortunately, board members have to focus on.
A final question, and if I can, I'll ask you to take out your crystal ball. You've pointed to the problems, the issues, and some of the potential solutions. Look ahead 3 to 5 years. What do you think the chances are that some or many of these suggestions will be adopted? Paint a picture for me of where we'll be in 5 years.
Well, we're somewhat optimistic that there's enough anger and outrage out there with people having lost as much money as they have, with the unemployment rates being where they are, with pension funds having been devastated, that if shareholders and taxpayers and others can get themselves informed and know where to direct that anger, that there'll be some changes. Unfortunately, the history has been that there are fig leaf reforms that deal with the last set of problems or some new requirements that people think take care of the problem, and the next bubble starts up, people return to the stock markets, complacency returns, and you get a recurrence of the problem. That's the danger, and we're hoping that the book will help get people energized and directed towards ensuring that there's some reforms, because we think it could help save a system that could work a lot better.
Okay, we've been speaking with John Gillespie, who is the co-author with David Zweig of Money for Nothing, How the Failure of Corporate Boards is Ruining American Business and Costing Us Trillions. John Gillespie, thanks so much for joining us.
Great, really appreciate it, Michael.